How can we teach meditation to our children, especially young children? Because they too can benefit enormously from learning how to make their minds peaceful and calm. And of course, that is a challenge, to take a 7-year-old, an 8-year-old, a 9-year-old and teach them something about Buddhism. I remember once being invited to a school in Australia, and I was invited to teach them Buddhism. But when I went to the school, I found out that the children I was to teach Buddhism to were grade 1. 5-6-year-olds. And how can you teach Buddhism to children who are only 5 years of age? If you talk about the Four Noble Truths, they haven't learned how to count to 4 yet. So it was a challenge, and at that particular time, these are the sorts of things you could use to teach some basic Buddhism. And what I did, I asked them, there was 2 classes, about 60 children, 5-year-olds, maybe the oldest was 6. Said, how many of you in this school like rice pudding? Now, rice pudding is a sweet they have in the West, with rice, milk and sugar, which is baked. How many of you like rice pudding? And about 3 children put their hand up straight away. Now, the other children, they're 5 or 6, they looked around, they saw 3 children had their hand up, so a few other children put their hand up. And then a few more, and within 1 minute, the whole school decided they liked rice pudding. And then, put your hands down, children. Now, please put your hand up, those children who have ever tried rice pudding. And only 6 children put their hand up, and all the other children laughed. I taught them ehi pasiko, pachatang weditabo winyuhi, to be experienced everyone by themselves. Because with children, 3 people said they liked rice pudding, and everyone else agreed, when most of the children hadn't even tasted it yet. And that was the message which I got across. Just like many people, do you like meditation? No, I don't like meditation. Have you ever tried it yet? No. You can see that sometimes that we have the same, sometimes, blocks that children have. We assume we can't do something when we haven't tried yet. So often, when I teach children, one of the biggest things to do is to take away those blocks of I cannot do. An example, I was a school teacher for 1 year before I left to become a monk. This was in a high school in UK, teaching teenagers. Teaching teenagers in the West is very different than teaching teenagers in Sri Lanka. In Sri Lanka, the children still have a lot of discipline. In the West, there's very little discipline at all. So trying to be a teacher in the West for 1 year is enough to make anyone consider leaving the world and becoming a monk. It's very tough. Well, actually, I enjoyed teaching the children at school. And so often, you had a child in your class who wasn't doing so well. And there was one such kid in my maths class. He wasn't doing well at all. And I asked the previous teachers how he did in the year before. And I wanted to find out whether this child actually could not do mathematics, or it was just he thought he could not do mathematics. So as his teacher, for the next 9 months, I gave this one kid special attention. When I set a problem on the board in the front of the classroom, and I'd walk along the desks, I'd always stop at this boy's desk, ask him, did you understand that? Now, was that okay? And I'd help him, and I'd always encourage him when he did well done. And I encouraged him so much, I gave him so much special attention. And this is absolutely a true story. By the end of the year, he actually came top in mathematics in my class. And that proved to me one important thing. There's no such thing as I cannot do mathematics. It's just you need encouragement and confidence. And this you can. Even as you know, in high profile sport, it is the attitude you have will depend, will make success or failure. It's not so much your skills, but your attitude. And as I've noticed, because one of my friends in Australia follows the Premier League soccer, and he noticed that the team which was always winning everything for years, Manchester United, this year they didn't do very well at all because their manager resigned. And it showed just how important the manager is. Not the players, but the manager. Because it's the manager who inspires confidence, which inspires the can-do attitude, which can take an ordinary team and make them champions. And I am the manager of all of you today. I'm going to try and inspire you to become champions in meditation, in Buddhism. And in your home, you are the manager of your children. And you have to be like a Sir Alex Ferguson. You have to be a manager who can inspire your children and say, yes, you can do that. It's possible in order for your children to reach their potential. So in Buddhism, we always say, please don't criticize too much. Please praise much more. Because you will find, it's basic psychology, but it's there in the Buddhist teachings, praise gets more out of people than any criticism will ever do. Which is why, when any monk manages to meditate for half an hour, well done! Tremendous, Bahoma Hondai, very good. And I always praise people, even if their meditation is not so good. Bahoma Hondai, very good. That's this monk is Korean. Juwayo, which is very good in Korean language. You know, I've learned the word very good in so many languages. Now, bagus sekali, that's in Indonesian. But I've never learned the word very bad. I don't know what that word is in Sinhala, and I don't want to know. I want to have praise rather than criticism. Because I asked one parent to do this a few days ago. Do you praise your children enough? Or do you criticize them too much? We always think, no, I love my kids. I praise them. But please take a piece of paper, even just for one day, and tick how many times you praise your child, and tick how many times you criticize them. Be honest about it, and you will find you criticize your kids much more than you ever praise them, which is one of the reasons why the kids don't live up to their potential and sometimes get naughty. They're not receiving enough boost of confidence, like I did with that child who was bottom of maths. Just with praise, confidence lifting, I took them to the very top. A good coach takes an ordinary team to the top. Imagine if the coach of the Sri Lankan cricket team, before the match, they told the 11 people playing in the field, you're hopeless, you can't win. You're a bunch of idiots. Even my grandmother can bowl better than you can. Imagine saying that. Is that going to help the team win? No way. But if you build them up and say, you've got a real chance this time. Now, their batting was terrible in the last match. This is where you can focus on. You're going to do this. You're going to win. It encourages people, inspires them, and they do win. That's the job of a good coach. And remember, don't just blame your children. Are you coaching them well? In very, very good Buddhist ways of encouraging. So when you understand the psychology of the mind, it's quite easy to actually to build your children up and give them that confidence. But the other thing, when people asked me the other day with children, how can we, say, stop children committing suicide in Sri Lanka? Apparently the suicide rate of teenagers is increased alarmingly. And about 4 or 5 years ago, when I was visiting Singapore, there was a very tragic story on the front page of the newspapers. A child, a teenager, had jumped from the window or the balcony of his apartment, many stories up, to his death. This young man had committed suicide. But what was really chilling was the suicide note he left. His suicide note read, "All I wanted was to spend more time with my mother and father. All I wanted was to spend more time with my parents." And that was the cause of his suicide. And that is really gets right inside of you. Your children, do you spend enough time with them? Ask your children. Maybe if you spend more time with them, take them out with a bat and ball or a soccer ball, whatever sport they like. Take them out, to the cricket stadium. Then maybe they would not be watching the videos on the computer so much. They wouldn't be spending so much time with SMSs. Kids need time with their parents. As this story in Australia, one of my favorite stories, mentions, I remember telling this story in Indonesia in front of a Muslim reporter, and she cried her eyes out afterwards. I'll tell you why. Because the story is of a young 6-year-old boy in Australia who was waiting for his daddy to come home from work. When the daddy came home from the office, the boy asked him, "Daddy, how much do you earn at work per hour?" And the father said, "None of your business, I'm tired." "Daddy, daddy, daddy, how many dollars do you earn at the office every hour?" "Look, I've told you. Don't ask me now. I've had a busy day." "But daddy, how much do you..." "That's it." And the father scolded the 6-year-old son. "I told you 3 times. You disobedient. Go up to your room." And that's how they punished him. Grounded him in the room. Couldn't watch the TV. When the father had had a cup of tea, he relaxed. He realized he was angry at his child simply because he was stressed out from a very busy day at work and driving home in the busy traffic. So he felt sorry. He went up to his child's bedroom, let himself in, and said sorry to his son. "I'm sorry, son. I shouldn't have been so harsh. And I don't know why you want to know how much I earn at work, but I earn $20 an hour at my work." And the son smiled and said, "Thank you, Daddy. Can I now borrow $10? And the father would usually get upset and angry, but he thought, "I've been angry once, I'm not going to get angry twice." So he opened up his wallet and gave his son a $10 note. And the son smiled at his father and said, "Thank you so much, Daddy." And then the son reached in the drawer next to his bed and took out another $10 in coins, counted out $20, handed it to his father and said, "Daddy, here's $20. Can I now have 1 hour of your time, please?" That's the story of our modern world. When I told that in Indonesia, the Muslim reporter cried her eyes out. She was a single mother who was working so hard to try and get her son a good life through working hard and getting money, not realizing what her son wanted more, even than a good education, was to see his mother. Now this is how we should look after our children. Get the priorities right. Children need their mum and dad. They need to be around. I have some great stories of my father. And my father was sometimes dishonest, but always for a good reason. I remember when I was 11 years of age, I made it into the school soccer team. I was so proud being in the school soccer team. We used to play on Saturday mornings, but unfortunately my father had to work on Saturday morning. And so I was so disappointed my father could not see me play soccer. And imagine a son's delight. For a little son, that meant so much to me. And after the game I said, "How did you manage to come and see me? I thought you were at work." He said, "Yes. I told my boss I had a doctor's appointment." Now, you're breaking precepts. You shouldn't do that. But, you know, for my dad, he would lie to see his son play soccer. Now, that really means a lot to me. It means a lot to me even now. But don't lie. Don't break precepts. Find another way. Children love that. Because what it's doing is not just assuming that you care for your kids. It's actually showing it with time. Spending time together. And it's important. And that, more than anything else, will protect your children from getting into bad company, doing bad things, doing drugs, suicide, and all this other stuff which children do because they're missing something in their life. But what I wanted to talk about also is, you know, some of you just want your children to, you know, keep precepts when they're young, and to also to even do some meditation. That's not impossible. But how to keep your children, or how to encourage your children to keep precepts. Number one, if you want your children to avoid taking drugs and alcohol later on in life, you, the parents, have to stop now. You cannot tell your children to don't drink when mummy and daddy drink alcohol. Children are wise enough to say, "Daddy, no, you drink alcohol, why can't I?" You can't tell your children not to smoke when daddy smokes. They will see that, they will know that, and they will not follow you. There's one of the stories of that great man, Gandhi. You know, Gandhi, before he became famous, he studied law in UK, in England. And he was staying in a boarding house while he was studying. And in the boarding house, the manager came up to Mr. Gandhi one day and said, "Can you please speak to my son? He's eating too much sugar. I try and tell him not to eat too much sugar, but he doesn't listen to me." For years, children do not listen to their parents. But the landlady said, "For some reason, my son respects you. He looks up to you." Even in those days, now Gandhi was a very impressive man. "I think," said the landlady, the manager of this little boarding house, "if you spoke to him, I think he might lessen the amount of sugar he eats." "Yes, madam," said Mr. Gandhi. The days went by, the weeks went by, and the landlady went to see Mr. Gandhi again. He said, "Mr. Gandhi, do you remember that I asked you to talk to my son about his sugar habit?" "Yes, madam, I remember." "But why haven't you talked to him? He's still taking lots and lots of sugar." "But madam, I have talked to your son, but only this morning." "Why did you wait so long?" said the landlady. "Because only yesterday I gave up eating sugar." That's why he became a great man. He would not tell anybody to give up something he hadn't given up himself first. That is the power of truth, integrity. Never asking someone to do what you don't do. So with your children, if you want to keep them within the bounds of precepts, to keep them safe from alcohol and drugs, remember, alcohol is just another drug in society. Mummy and daddy, the parents, have to do that first of all. And then the children will listen to you. But you know that sometimes, even so, some children, especially when they get to be teenagers or in their early 20s, they are also very, very difficult to talk to. They get to an age when they think they're independent. They think they know best and they won't listen to their parents. But as Buddhists, we understand psychology. We know how to actually get our teenagers, or, you know, young 20s, to do the right thing. There was a son of one of my disciples in Perth. He was at university, but he was spending too many evenings out with his girlfriends in nightclubs, watching music, spending so much time at these events that he wasn't studying and his grades at university were going down, down, down. And there was a real danger he may get kicked out of university. And no matter what his mother and father said, he would not listen to them. He liked going out in the evening. But his father was a very clever Buddhist, a Malaysian Chinese. So one evening he was waiting for his son, 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, when his son came back from another evening out with his girlfriend. He was waiting for them as the car came into the driveway. "Come inside, both of you," he said. And his son was scared, was terrified. "What's my father going to do? Is he going to embarrass me in front of my girlfriend?" But his father never spoke to the son, just spoke to his girlfriend. He sat them down in the lounge room and said to the girlfriend, "Please excuse me for talking to you, but I've noticed you've been going out for many weeks now. I do not know how your relationship is going, but maybe one day you may commit, you may even get married. And I wanted to inform you that my son's grades at university are getting very, very bad, and he may even get kicked out of university. Did you know that?" And the girlfriend said, "No, he never told me that. I never knew." "And I'm sure you don't want to marry someone who's a dummy, who hasn't got a good job." "No, I want to marry a successful guy. I just thought I'd let you know. Good night." And then he left them both. And from that time on, his girlfriend was always checking his results and his grades. And if he wasn't doing good enough, "Stay home tonight. You're going to study. I'm not going out with you." It was his girlfriend who had all the power over him. And so his grades went up and he passed his university. We call that girlfriend power. Everyone has a weak point. And you just got to find that weak point. If it's your girl that's misbehaving and she's got a nice boyfriend, don't talk to your daughter. She won't listen. Talk to the boyfriend. Gang up on her. And once you've got the boyfriend on side, you've got full leverage. You can do whatever you want with your daughter. That is the psychology of looking after children. Finding out, you know, their weak points, what they really, really, you know, want to, how they can be influenced. And then you've got full power and you can influence them to be good people. But it's also sometimes, just like adults, children like to learn from simple stories. Which is why in Buddhism we have all these amazing stories which teach children how to be good people. And I teach these children's stories to adults, and you enjoy them even more than children. Because everyone likes a good story. And don't just tell them the old Jataka tales. Because the Jataka tales, they don't really relate that much to modern life. But we can adapt them. We can make new ones. Just like the story of how a mouse trap killed a chicken, a pig, and a cow. Once upon a time, there were 5 mice who lived in a farmhouse. And those five mice had three friends, a chicken, a pig, and a cow. And these mice living in the farmhouse would always look after their friends. If they're living in the farmhouse, if they heard that the farmer wanted roast chicken, they would run to where the chicken lived and tell the chicken, hide, so disappear, fly away, or do something, get away. They're looking for you to make roast chicken. And so the chicken would hide, and the farmer couldn't find the chicken, so they didn't have chicken that day. Or when they heard that the farmer's wife wanted to make sausage rolls, which they used pig, they looked for the pig and told it to pretend to be sick. Lie on your back as if you've got some disease, and then they won't kill you. Or when they wanted to make steak, they told the cow, run into the next field, hide in the bushes, they're looking for you to make steak. And that way, the five mice managed to protect their friends. And their friends used to call those five mice MI5, Mouse Intelligence 5. And one day, one of those mice, they were looking through a hole, you know, in the wall where they lived. And they saw the farmer's wife get a package from the post. And as she opened the package, the poor mouse almost had a heart attack. Because the little mouse saw the farmer unwrap a mouse trap. They're trying to kill us. They're trying to execute us. We're going to die. We're going to be toast. We're dead. Because when you put a mouse trap in the house, the nature of mice is to run all over the place, even if they're mindful. And mice aren't mindful, by the way. Even if they're careful, somewhere, sooner or later, they're going to step in that mouse trap and be killed. So they were terrified. They met together. What should we do? They couldn't think of anything to do, so they thought, we'll go and ask our best friend, Mrs. Chicken. Now, she's bigger than us. She'll be able to understand or give us some advice. So they went to see Mrs. Chicken and asked her, please help us. There's a mousetrap in the house. We're going to die. And the chicken said, nothing to do with me. How can a mousetrap kill a chicken? Look after yourselves. And they were so disappointed. All the times they've helped the chicken, when they needed help from the chicken wouldn't give them any help. So they went to Mr. Pig. And Mr. Pig, all Mr. Pig said was, oink, 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 oink. None of my business, oink. The mousetrap can't kill me, oink. So they went to see Mrs. Cow. And Mrs. Cow was so busy chewing grass, never even gave the mice even one moo. None of my business, thought the cow. Mousetrap, big cow, how can a mousetrap kill a cow? Look after yourselves. And the mice were so disappointed. When they needed help, it was none of their business to their friends. And they were so disappointed. And that night, one of the mice was looking for a midnight snack, running along the kitchen. And it was running along the kitchen when suddenly... Now, whenever you give Dharma Desana, it's always good to do things like that, because it wakes people up. They pay attention again. Went the mousetrap. And that poor mouse was killed and went straight up to heaven. Do you think mice have a heaven when they're good? If they do have a heaven, it must be a separate heaven for good cats. Otherwise, it won't be much of a heaven for the mice. So, that poor mouse was killed. And all the other four mice, they heard that sound. They ran out to see what was happening, see if they could help their friend. And what did they see? They saw their friend dead in the mouse trap.
And I started crying and sobbing. And they would hold each other in their arms, just like human beings do, trying to comfort each other. Their friend, their brother, had been killed. And they were crying and sobbing around the mousetrap. And the farmer's wife, she heard the and went to investigate. And what she saw were four mice sobbing with grief, holding each other up in their distress. Have you ever seen something like that? She had never seen anything like that in her life. And so she fainted. And as she fainted, she hit her head on the floor. And when the farmer found her, she was unconscious. The farmer had to put her to bed. It was too far away to get the doctor straight away. So he thought, what can I give my wife to make her better? What can I give her? And he read in an article in a magazine, chicken soup is very good when you're sick. Where can I get chicken soup from? So he found that chicken, cut off the chicken's head, put it in a pot with some with some salt, some garlic and potatoes, and made chicken soup for his wife who was sick. That is how the mousetrap killed the chicken. The Michelin guide in France, they actually rate chefs, and five-star chef is the best in the world. So as soon as he read in the paper, there was such a chef coming into one of the best restaurants in Colombo, he made a reservation. And once he made the reservation, he was told he had to wait 2 months. That's how popular the restaurant was. Everybody wanted to go there. But he didn't mind waiting. When 2 months went past, he dressed in a fine suit, because good restaurants have a dress code. They wouldn't let me in. Talking about dress codes, you know, once I had the great honor of being invited to a state dinner with Queen Elizabeth. It was the Commonwealth Games in Australia. And at that time, John Howard was the Prime Minister. And at the same time, there was a Commonwealth Interfaith Service in front of Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II. So I was invited to represent the Buddhists in Australia. And because I went to represent the Buddhists in front of Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth, actually, I'll let you know a little secret. You know why the Queen Elizabeth wears big hats? You know why? Because during the service in the cathedral, she fell asleep. And when her head goes down, you can't see her eyes close. So no one knows she's taking a nap. That's true. Please, I apologize, Her Majesty, but that's why she wears big hats in church. You can fall asleep without anyone noticing. But anyway, afterwards, there was also a state dinner in the Grand Hall of Parliament in Canberra. And I got an invitation signed by the Prime Minister, John Howard. And I wondered what to do. Now, I said, I can't eat any dinner because I'm a monk. It's in the evening. But it was such a great honor for Buddhism. Should I go? But there was a very big problem. The problem was, on the bottom of the invitation, dress code. Now, maybe, you know, you can go into Parliament House, dress as a monk in Sri Lanka, but not in Australia. At least that's what I thought. I looked at the first possibility. The first choice was black tie. Now, I'm a monk. I don't know these things. I thought, is that all you have to wear? Just a black tie? No shirt, no trousers, just a black tie. They said, no, black tie means the shirt, the suit, and everything else. But then why don't they say that? They just say black tie. So I mean, we didn't have a black tie in the monastery. A monk can't wear a tie. So what else was there? The next option was military uniform.
A monk can't dress as an army general or a navy admiral. We don't have any military uniforms. So the first two choices, you know, was impossible. I looked at the third choice and I thought, yes, I can go as that. Black tie, first choice. Military uniform, second choice. Third choice was long dress. And in the West, this is what this looks like. So, dress code is very important sometimes. So, he had a very fine dress, fine suit on. And he went to the restaurant. They checked his ID. He had a reservation that night, so they brought him into the restaurant. It's a very beautiful restaurant. Lovely decorations, just soft light. Now, light enough so you can see where you are and what you're eating, but sort of like twilight, dark enough to give you some sense of privacy and seclusion. Just the right lighting for the best restaurants. And then the waiter came, you know, the whole works in a tail like an English butler, and gave him the menu. And the menu was written on thick parchment, not like in McDonald's, but thick parchment, with beautiful gold calligraphy, with a crimson border. Even the menu was like a work of art. And the professor said thank you to the waiter, and the waiter left. And as soon as the waiter left, the professor began to eat the menu. And when he finished eating the menu, he paid his bill and left. Because the professor does not know the difference between the menu and the food. That's just like the professors of Abhidharma. They know all about the menu, and that's all they ever eat. The menu. They never actually order and eat the food. They never actually keep the precepts. They know the precepts, but they never keep them. They know the theory of meditation, but they never meditate. They know the Four Noble Truths, but they never penetrate them and make them their own. They're like the professor who only eats menus. Do you know what I mean? So you get the beautiful food there. For goodness sake, eat it. That's why sometimes in Sri Lanka you've got the best food in the world, the best menus, the Dhamma. Please eat it. So how can you teach your children to actually eat the food? Again, I had a class of Western school children come to my temple and I had to teach them five precepts. And so how can you teach maybe 7, 8-year-olds five precepts? So what I said, I went back to the core of the five precepts. Same with any of you. If any of you cannot keep the five precepts, please keep the two precepts. You know, some people, five is too much these days. So just keep two. And the two precepts are never doing anything which might hurt another living being. That's precept number one. Precept number two, never intentionally do anything which hurts or harms yourself. Precept number two. And that's what I told these kids. And they can understand that. That makes sense. Why would you do something which hurts yourself? Why would you do anything which hurts another human being? You don't want to be hurt, so why would you want to hurt someone else? And that was the advice which the Buddha gave to his son Rahula. So, then I asked the kids, what hurts other people? Give me some examples. And then they started to say, you know, my friend hitting me. So, killing. When someone steals something from you. Yes, stealing. And even, amazing, 6 or 7-year-old kids understood adultery. Now, because unfortunately that happens. And I remember asking the child, well, what's wrong if your, you know, if your husband commits adultery and you get divorced? And I remember this little child said, it's terrible being with only one parent, because when my mummy gets angry with me, I haven't got a daddy to hug. When my daddy scolds me, I haven't got a mother to kiss me. That's why we need two. When someone gets angry and scolds you, you've always got a spare to love you.
And I remember that's what they said. It was very sweet. They needed two parents in case one got angry at them. They always had another one to be kind to them. So they realized they got adultery and alcohol. They even got that one too. So sometimes daddy gets drunk. And I hate it when daddy is drunk. The kids saw that. And they also, you know, saw lying was bad. And it was only took 5 minutes, and these 7 or 8 year olds, you know, from the basics of don't do anything which hurts yourself or hurts others, they got all the Buddha's 5 precepts. They hadn't heard Buddhism before. Children understand what hurts, what harms. Maybe they don't think enough to try and excuse things, to try and find a reason for doing bad things. As adults, we always tend to find a reason, an excuse for doing bad things. Oh, it's just what we have to do in business. Oh, it's only a little white lie. Lies aren't white. They're dark. Adultery is bad. I don't know in Sri Lanka, but I know in the West, when people get married, the bride is always wearing white and the groom wears a dark suit. Is that the same in Sri Lanka sometimes? No, but sometimes it is. But you know, in the West, that's how people get married. And someone once told me, why it is that the bride, the girl wears white, is a symbol of her purity. So why does a groom wear dark clothes? What does that say about men? So, if you're a good man, you wear white too. And if you're a bad girl, you wear a dark dress. But certainly, you know, we can teach children, and children can understand a lot about precepts, about why it is, you know, to be kind and be good. And of course, we encourage this with stories. Over in Perth, there was a front page story in the local newspaper about a young boy who was maybe 11, 12 years of age. He was riding his bicycle back from school, going back home, when he saw two older children, maybe 14-year-old children. They'd captured a little rabbit, and they were torturing this poor little rabbit. Now, this was two 14-year-old kids were, you know, misbehaving with this rabbit, and there's an 11-year-old kid riding his bike. And he was courageous enough to stop his bike and stand up to these bigger children. That takes a lot of courage for a small kid to stand up to two bigger kids. So leave that rabbit alone. Stop hurting it. And of course, they took no notice. And he said, I will give you my bicycle, which was a BMX expensive bicycle. I will give you my bicycle if you give me that rabbit. And for those two 14-year-olds, they looked at the bicycle. It was expensive, and they could always get another rabbit, they thought. So they gave this kid the rabbit, and he took it home. And he lost his bike. When his mother said, where's your bicycle? What's this rabbit doing? When he told the story, his parents were so proud of their son. Now, to save the life of a rabbit, he'd sacrifice his own bicycle. They rang up the newspaper, and it was the front page the following morning. Good news story, that children are kind enough to let go of their own possessions, possessions they liked and loved and cared for, his bike, to save the life of a little animal. Isn't that a beautiful story? The next day, there was another article in the newspaper. He got 3 new bicycles. Owners of shops have read that article and said, that is a good kid, and they've delivered 3 more bicycles to his place. They said, there, that's karma. Karma and vipaka. You know, even you don't be a Buddhist, you do something kind, people hear about it, and this is what you get back. So children like that, they have a good heart often, if they can be encouraged and see such stories, and it encourages us to do the same. You know, it's more important to save somebody's life, to care for animals, to care for any human being. Forget about your possessions. It's more important that you're kind to people. You get the possessions back again afterwards anyway. So these are stories which encourage people to be good, to be kind, and also your children to be good and kind as well. And just before here, I was talking to a young couple and asked them, do you argue? And of course you argue. Husbands and wives argue. That's why they say in the first year of marriage, in the first year of marriage, the wife listens to the husband. In the second year of marriage, the wife gets confidence and the husband has to listen to the wife. In the third year of marriage, your neighbors listen to both of you. That's when you start arguing. And the neighbors can hear it too. But I remember my parents would argue. But what I did also remember, that they would make up. After 1 or 2 hours, they had to make up. Because we lived in a small apartment. You couldn't escape from one another. But what I remember from my childhood, I remember my parents arguing. And I remember them making up in front of me. And that was such a beautiful thing for a child to see. To see their mother and father hugging and kissing and saying sorry together. That's what I remember from my childhood. What I learned was arguments are natural. You will argue with your friends. You will argue, you know, with your partner in life. That's nature. But what is beautiful is that you make up. Hug, kiss, say sorry. And if you do that, please do it in front of your children. Because they love seeing that. And they learn so much that yes, we will have arguments with our friends, but we know the beauty of saying sorry and making up. And if you can do that, and your children learn how to do that, then later on in their life, when your children become members of Parliament, they will know after an argument in Parliament House, how to make up. In front of the TV cameras. What a beautiful sight that is to see. Yeah, we can argue, but at least we can respect each other, love each other, and show our kindness, compassion, and respect to one another. And that's what I learned. So please teach your children that. When you do have arguments, don't be embarrassed. It's nature. But please always make up in front of your kids to show them the beauty of reconciliation. Children love that, as I always loved that moment. It was almost worth the argument, waiting for that moment when Mum and Dad hugged, kissed, cried, and made up together. So I wanted to also say how you can teach your children how to meditate. That's also part of Buddhism. And people often ask, what age can you teach children how to meditate? And I've experimented, even very young children, 7, 8 years of age. You can teach them how to meditate, but you have to adapt the meditation for children of that sort of age. So instead of teaching them how to watch the breath, which is far too difficult for 7 or 8 years of age, one of the things I've noticed with young children is they've got huge powers of imagination. They can imagine and visualize even much more than most adults. I think that they haven't learned how to think. And the thinking actually stops our powers of visualization, so we can't imagine in the same way we used to do as a child when we hadn't learned to think and criticize so much. So understanding that, I remember my first class of young children. So how I taught the children how to meditate when they were very young was I taught them to visualize. I sat them down and I asked them to close their eyes and relax as much as they possibly could with their body. And then I asked them, this was in Perth, you know, next to the Indian Ocean. Just actually, that's what connects us to Sri Lanka. It's only a little ocean between us. So I asked them to imagine relaxing their body and floating out of their body over to the ocean. Because children love the beach and the ocean, especially in Australia. Imagine floating out of your body over the ocean. And you go out into the ocean, into your special place in the ocean. And you just gently drop into the ocean. And it's nice and calm and warm. You don't have to struggle, you just float there with the water suspending your body. And you look around, there's no ships, there's no land. You're just by yourself in this beautiful, warm piece of ocean. There's a gentle, warm breeze. You can feel it as it floats over the ocean. And you can see the birds flying overhead. And it's so warm, not hot, no cold, just right. As you're floating there alone, no brothers or sisters, no mummy or daddy to disturb you. Peaceful, free, at ease. And I go on like this for about 10 minutes. Were you enjoying that? They really enjoyed it. And after 10 minutes, I say, now's the time for you to come home. Say goodbye to your special place in the ocean. Imagine yourself floating out of the water, relaxed at peace, flowing out over the ocean. You can see the shoreline of Perth. You float over the beach, over the houses, into the temple, come back into your body. Relax, now open your eyes. And they love that. And I taught that to these kids over 30 years ago. And when they grew up, I thought they'd change to Anapanasati. No. That is a meditation they learned as a kid. That's the meditation they do now. And I mentioned that one of those kids I taught meditation to, they became a chef. And they competed in the Australian version of MasterChef. And they won it. They won it, you know, the MasterChef competition. And they said, not him, his sister came up to me and said, you know, Herbert, he won the MasterChef. I said, I expected so, because when you're competing, you can get very nervous. So he meditated before the show, floating out of his body over to the ocean, away from the studio and all those lights, peaceful, free. So when he came back again, he was so relaxed. Of course he wins. So sometimes what you teach your children, they keep for the whole life. And it allows them to actually win, succeed in life, because they know how to relax. So that's a little technique you can teach your children. You can adapt it, you know, to what your children likes. Floating up into the mountains, peaceful, cool, still. Elaborate on it, let them feel it, because it's their imagination and their emotional response will give them that sense of peace, freedom and stillness. And they'll have this beautiful, beautiful journey. And they remember that for life. Whenever they're stressed out, whenever they're in a difficult situation, they will know how to find their beautiful, peaceful place in the ocean, which is always there for them at any time. And they can imagine it and go back there for the rest of their life. Thank you so much for listening.